Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 139, with guests from Real World Theology and the Body and the Blood podcast, Blake Collier. Also, first-time guest to the show, Ryan Parker, the creator of Pop Theology. So listen up, because we've got a really GTA-esque show for you. On this episode, we talk Baby Driver and subversive cultural privilege.
Well, I am not exactly sure how you guys feel about Edgar Wright. That's a lie. I know
he's a damn genius.
I think he's a genius.
Yeah.
I don't think Blake thinks that, because I was reading the review that Blake posted at realworldtheology.com.
I read that.
where he says that, you know, he's not particularly fond of him for some reason. Blake,
I don't know why I'm not just by, you know, chomping at the bit to see every movie that comes out that he does. Like, the only movie I really didn't care for was Scott Pilgrim, and I need to watch it again, because I think maybe came out at a time that it just wasn't hitting on all cylinders for me.
I've liked every movie he's done. It would check all your boxes, it seems.
Yeah, and so I probably just need to watch it again. But I like every one of his movies. I just don't know what it is, like, why I don't get excited when I hear he's got a new movie. But I always enjoy them, you know, so.
I always think he has way more movies than I think he does.
Yeah.
I think that's partly because I have not watched any of his movies, like the four of them or five of them, that I have not enjoyed. And usually even the directors that I really, really like, there's something that I don't like, or that's kind of like, meh.
Yeah.
And I just keep thinking, oh, there must have been like one of his early films that I just hadn't seen yet or something like that. And I'm nope. And then apparently I'm not the only one, because, you know, we're here to talk about Baby Driver, and Baby Driver is another one written and directed by Edgar Wright. So far, the critics have loved his movies. I mean, I guess technically, if you want to do the Rotten Tomatoes meter, then up until Baby Driver, he's been kind of slowly, like the most slow gradient ever, because his Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead started at 92, Hot Fuzz went down to 91, World's End was at 89. It's just this gradual slope of downward quality, I guess. But, you know, I think it's hard for anyone to really like hit the upper 80s, low 90s with like all their films. I think that's just an incredible achievement in and of itself, which is one of the reasons I was really excited about Baby Driver. Kind of pointing that out, like Baby Driver itself is currently sitting at 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, which just seems like an almost impossible thing these days. I mean, it's the highest rated of all his films. And like I said, the critics are obviously liking it, but I think the movie's actually doing pretty well, like relative at the box office. You know, it's crammed in a weekend where like Transformers was before it. It's coming out the same weekend as Despicable Me 3, which I know is a different audience, but still, like, people having time to go to the theater 4th of July weekend. Seems like it's making decent money. I went to a showing at like 10:15 at night, and the theater was about 2/3 full, which is just not something that happens where I'm at, because there's so many, there's like 5 or 6 theaters in like a 10-mile radius. And so people can see it almost any time, and it was still 2/3 full. So I'm kind of curious, like, why are people like going to see this movie? Because I know the average person does not know who Edgar Wright is, like, apart from any other director. So are they seeing something in this film? Why are you guys going to see this film? Besides the fact that we all do film and theology, and we're going to get to see the movie because.
I was having a discussion with some people about this last night on kind of like the marketing side. And as much as we talk about kind of the viral nature of social media and like hashtag and all this kind of stuff, I still think word of mouth is the most effective form of marketing. And I think to go see a film like this and you walk out, you're going to tell somebody you should go see this movie because, and the, especially the way all the reviews, I find it funny that all like the remotely religious reviews of the film are like, there's no really great moral here at play, yeah. right? It's just a fun movie. And guess what? That's why people go to the movie theaters, because it's a fun movie. And most of the time, you know, people don't want to go to the movie theater. It's not silence. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I mean, so I think that was one of the things that I really enjoyed as well, because I'm sitting here kind of parsing through these reviews and they're just like, hey, look, we went to see this movie. Everyone's seeing this movie, or everyone. A lot of people are seeing this movie. Critics are loving this movie, but we just had fun. And it's okay to have fun. And we've talked about movies where you can go and just have fun on the podcast before. But I'm kind of curious, like, what is it about the movie that's fun? Like, what is it about this specific movie? Because, like lots of people go see Marvel movies because they're fun, because they have characters that are, like, over the top and exciting, and we all love superheroes somewhere deep down, even if people are like, oh, superheroes, I'm so tired of them. We still love superheroes, and we love superhero stories. But what is Baby Driver doing that's fun, Blake?
Well, I think in some ways it's distilling down a known narrative that, so you know, tons of films have covered. Like, it's nothing new narratively. It's the same basic setup as any heist film, basically. But it, like, the way Edgar Wright had approached the film, it's like he wanted to basically take out all of the stuff that is put in the narrative in order to make it seem more complex than it really is. And he just strips it all down. And instead his thing is, he's like, no, I'm just going to make this really simple film and I'm going to put it to some really hella good music. And I think that's what does it, is like, it's basically just getting down to what is enjoyable and what is beautiful about that very simple narrative. And that's why, you know, I was struggling when I was writing my review, because I was just like, I don't know how to talk about this, because really it's a feeling more than it is like anything I could, you know, honestly say about the film on any kind of like theological or moral level or anything like that. It's more just, this is the first time since Die Hard that I felt like I could actually just sit there and enjoy it and not have to think about it. And not in that bad way where you're just, you know, letting violence wash over you, but mm-hmm. just to enjoy pure cinema, to enjoy what cinema does well. And it brings you into a story. It inundates you, like, it inundates your senses. And you just get lost in the film. And that's what this movie did for me, is it was something that I could come out and be like, I had a really good time watching that film. I couldn't tell you why I had a good time. All I know is that I haven't felt this way since I was a kid.
Well, but that's good art, though.
Yeah, yeah, I was saying, exactly. We're going to get to the bottom of it, though. Like,
yeah.
We're not going to let you cop out and do that.
No, I'm hoping that the discussion will parse some of that out for me. So, well,
I also need to go into the iTunes clean label now and see if Hella is going to cost us our clean tag now.
No, it took me every bit of me to not drop the F-bomb there. I just want to let you know. So.
I appreciate that. you guys, I think there's two or three of you now who are going to try to fend for the title of dirtiest podcast guest, which is so crazy, because we have these conversations all the time and like it's so little. But so Blake, you're having fun. Mm-hmm. Is it the music? Is it the action? Is it the characters? What is the thing that's sticking out to you most? Like, when you leave, are you humming a tune? What is it?
I think it is a large part of the music. Because the music, when I saw the soundtrack listing, that's actually what got me excited about the movie, which is funny because you wouldn't think that. Usually the soundtrack is meant to be something that, yeah, you buy after the fact. Like, but I had already bought it and listened to it before I saw the movie. And because I was like, these are really good songs. This is a really solid mixtape, basically. And I was listening to it, and I was just like, I got excited about the film because I was like, so there's a movie podcast I listen to. It's BBC 5 Film Review with Mark Kermode. And they were basically talking to Kevin Spacey and Edgar Wright in an interview. And Edgar Wright was talking about how he did the choreography. And he said that they had the little pieces in their hair that would play the music during each scene. So like the actors would basically slow down or quicken their pace or their speech or the action that they were doing based on the rhythm and the beat of the music. Hmm. Like they were consciously attempting to match their movements and their speech to the song that was played for that scene. And so there's this, what's so beautiful is that it's the first 15 minutes or so, the initial heist, that you start to see, like, you can tell that there's a choreography there, the way that they kind of intro it. But the rest of the film, like, you have to, if you don't get sucked into the film by that point, which you'll lose a lot of that, like, consciousness of watching for that choreography, it's there.
Yeah.
But you just get lost in the film. And so, but that first 15 minutes, like, it's very clear that everything is based on that song, especially Bell Bottom by the John Spencer Blues Explosion. That's kind of the song they open with, and starts out with that tinnitus sound, and then he puts in the music, and that's when the movie starts. And it's beautiful the way that's done. And I think I was just really impressed that he's willing to try something so, that seems like a incredibly risky thing to try to do. and a pretty high factor of failure going into it. And he had already gotten all the sampling rights to the songs and everything before he'd, you know, basically done this, you know, film the movie, because he didn't want to switch out the songs when he was filming it, because that was part of the whole film, you know, is tying it to the music. So the music is a character in the film. And I think that is what kind of brought me into the movie, and what I came out really just appreciating. Like I said in my review, it's a musical for people who hate musicals. and I fit in that category. It's fun. Like the energy, it's very frenetic. The way he ties in the music into the story, like, this is not arbitrary the way he's picking these songs. Like, this is stuff that has meaning within the scope of each scene. And that just allows for, you know, the more I watch the movie, which I'll probably be watching again very shortly, is you can dig into each scene and dig into the song and maybe see some crossover on what he's trying to do. And maybe you can get some pretty heavy meaning at that point. There's just endless ways to kind of tear apart the film.
Well, so you talked about how this film doesn't really do anything genre wise. Like, it's a heist film. It's a fairly straightforward heist film. Yet there's lots of people talking about how it does defy genres, and it does. It sounds like your description that you would classify this film as a musical.
Yeah, it's a different kind of musical, though.
Okay.
I don't think you could honestly say it's a straightforward musical at all, but...
So I'm kind of curious, from Ryan, like, I know that you probably see just a jillion movies a year, if that's even a number. I'm kind of curious, like, do you see this as a musical? And if it is, like, how is it defying that?
I would call it, I don't understand, I guess I would call it like an action musical. And maybe the fact that people say it's genre defying, which that's not the first response I would have had to it,
yeah,
is because it is using the musical in service of the action, and maybe the action in service of the musical component. I'm not saying that other musicals don't do that, but I think they're not often of the heist car chase variety, and yeah. So maybe that's where people are coming in with that. And I'm a person who I do love musicals, and I think Singing in the Rain is one of the greatest movies ever made.
I would agree with that. It's one of the few I actually like.
Yeah, and so, you know, did I think I left the theater with that kind of same sense of enjoyment as Singing in the Rain just because it is like fun and knows exactly what it is and what it wants to be.
Do you think anyone else besides Edgar Wright could have done this?
Sure. Yeah, but not as well. I mean, part of the reason I'm such a fan of his is that I think I'm hard pressed to think of a director, certainly a writer director, who has turned out five films of such aesthetic quality, that of pushing an envelope of the way he edits and the way where he makes his cuts, the sound design, all these things, so intentionally that, yeah, I don't know that I would have trusted the concept to any other director, yeah. Not even Tarantino.
Yeah. I think the only,
because he has a different rhythm.
Yeah. It's a much different rhythm. I think the only director that comes to mind when I ask a question like that is someone like Wes Anderson, who, has produced something, I think, consistently good through, as far as I can remember, all of his films. But at the same time, the things that make Wes Anderson Wes Anderson are not things that would have worked in this film.
What Wes Anderson and Edgar Wright are sitting at different nerd tables.
Yeah, yes. They are both super nerdy, right? Like we're,
but they're different in a different way.
Yeah. So I don't think Wes Anderson could have done the film, but like when you're sitting there saying like, you know, does anyone do anything like this that has like a distinct style that works over and over and over
point.
Again?
That's a good point. They've captured their style and they're seeing it through all these films.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good comparison.
And I wish more films from both of them, right? I want to sit at both their tables.
Exactly.
I want to be in a ballroom where they both have those circular tables, and I want to sit in a chair where those two tables kind of Venn diagram together and just watch everything that they put out.
I'd probably choose to sit at Edgar Wright's table more likely. I like Wes Anderson, but Wes Anderson has a higher hit to miss ratio than Edgar Wright. Like Edgar Wright, the one film I don't like by him, I probably need to watch again because I'll probably like it.
You definitely watch it. Well, so the point wasn't to compare the two is like who's better or worse, but just I feel like it's still rare to see someone doing something that we've seen done many, many, many times. I mean, yeah. I even sent you guys the link, and I'll probably add it to the show notes of just like all the films that influence Edgar Wright in doing this, and by the fact that there are 10 films that highly influence Edgar Wright into making this film means that this has obviously been done, or many of the pieces of his movie have been done before and he's doing something different. So I'm actually, this kind of goes back to trying to kind of poke Blake a little bit more, but Ryan, I'm kind of curious for you to answer it first. What is it that Edgar Wright is doing that's setting it apart from like The Italian Job or Bullet or Smokey and the Bandit? Like what is Edgar Wright doing? Is it just like the culmination of things, or is it just he makes car chases better than anybody now? Like we give him that flag. What is it?
Well, I definitely don't think he makes the best car chases. I've seen much better car chases. But I find that what he does well is that, I mean, the more films you watch in your life, the more you can kind of pick up on influences of any director. What I see with this film, and I saw some of the films that kind of influenced this one for him, and I've seen some of them. But I think what I see about Edgar Wright is that he takes all these puzzle pieces and he puts them together in a puzzle that only he could put it together in. And so, like, it's unique because he's the one controlling the puzzle. But the pieces themselves are not unique. So he's basically just able to take the elements that have kind of gone before him and put them in a way that
so it's something new.
It's something new, and I think if nothing else, like you could say that I personally can't think of another film where music was so heavily involved in a heist. like a heist film. Like I can't think of a film that even relates to that off the top of my head. And so I think there's an element there that is key, and it's unique to him in that he has a very pop culture sensibility to him. Like that's where the draw is, the way he likes to kind of take a pulse of the of society and see what people are nerding out about, and then try to work that into his the way he makes films, and I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. I think I think what he's doing that other filmmakers don't do, or other, you know, if you look at those 10 films that he says influenced him, they all have a cool or a style about them. The way I think that Baby Driver is a cool, stylish film, in its own way, and I think it, in its way, it's using, like those older films might have had a star like Steve McQueen, and you just knew that's one bad dude, like. But you can't necessarily, other than maybe Jamie Foxx, like there's no huge star in the film. It's not a, I mean, Kevin Spacey, but he's a bit of a supporting character. Like you're, you know, Baby is not an, you know, is it Anselm?
Yeah,
Ansel Elgort.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a household name yet. I mean, it probably never will be, quite frankly, but his, you know, but its sense of style and cool, Blake, as you pointed out, is in the music and its use of music. And I think in its editing, the rhythm, the intentionality, those are things I think that are setting it apart. And, you know, a lot of your heist films don't have as interesting. I mean, look, Baby having the car wreck and everything. I think most films would have said it's enough for Baby to have been an orphan who's been rescued by this guy. But then you give him that flaw of the tinnitus and needing the music, and that making it so integral to the story, I think is really smart. It's something that I think most writers wouldn't have done. They would have just been content to say Baby's an orphan trying to pay off his debt, but he gets roped into one last rodeo. But where Edgar Wright's genius, I think, goes, yeah, but what if he had this defect where he needed music? And what if I made that music like the heartbeat of the movie? I think that's what sets it apart.
Well, and I think the heart of the movie kind of lies in the fact that it comes back full circle. Like part of the reason why he's doing these jobs for Spacey is he has that tape of his mom that he wants back.
Yeah.
And there's that. So yeah, he kind of have him. You have the whole car wreck scenario in his background, but the one thing he actually wants is not money. It's not anything like that. He just wants to be connected again to the family he lost. And so I found that pretty touching. And I think the last time I felt that way was probably the first 10, 15 minutes of the first Guardians of the Galaxy. So
that's a good note too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh. Now I just want to sit and talk about how the opening of the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie just completely hooked me, and so they can basically do anything they want now. I'm going to go see it because I always want James Gunn to do anything that good again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was Guardians 2 was slightly disappointing because I went back thinking, I want that feeling all over again. And you know, I don't think I got it. And
oh,
that,
yeah. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
So, I always have trouble with something like this because we've already established the fact that Baby Driver is mostly, I mean, heck, most of the reviews, most of the people that we typically link in show notes who are thoughtfully reviewing film and theology or film from a theological perspective or even from a thematic perspective have mostly come out on the side that this is a for fun movie. So I don't want to co-opt this movie. I don't want to put words in Edgar Wright's mouth. I don't want to say that he was making a film that he was, you know, with a theme that he was not intending or trying to say that wasn't. But I do think there is some situational stuff that we see in a movie like Baby Driver that kind of, because it's fun, maybe we don't think about it, or maybe we should think about it and not let it always parse as fun so easily. And one of those things is the idea of consequences, because it ties into things that I love about Edgar Wright's films or how he makes films. I feel like he doesn't make a film because he's bored. I don't feel like he makes a film because someone came and offered him a ton of money to make a film. I think he's got a story to tell and a sensibility to do that and an incredibly well done visual style where he doesn't waste anything. And since he's not wasting anything, he's not really wasting transition. He's not, most of the time, and though I could level it against this film, he tends not to have large plots of exposition. When something's not wasted, it means when he puts something in the film, it means he's going to typically realize it further down the road in the film. And Elijah Davidson actually said this about Baby Driver. He said, there are consequences in Edgar Wright's stories for everything the characters do. And I mean consequences in both the cause effect and moral sense of the word. Nothing is wasted. He is faithful to play out the logical and ethical ramifications of his character's actions. And I think that I believe it, Ryan, you were kind of talking about that a little bit. Well, actually, both of you, I think, were about how he didn't just give the main character like this cool thing that he does. He actually talked about the implications of having it's technically a disability at this point, that he needs the music to cover up this thing that happened to him and all the ways that ties back into his life. So I'm kind of curious if you guys saw any or were amazed or really connected with any parts that pushed that forward. Like, would this movie and a heist film normally have ended at a certain point? And does Edgar Wright push it forward? What are the consequences that we see for actions? What's the cause and effect? What's the moral implications of things, the choices that people are making? Ryan.
You know, I watched it, and I gotta tell you, I don't know if this is on topic or not, and if it's not, we can save it for later, but I feel like there, you know, when you talk about consequences, one of the films that I think of the most, that I think does that the best, is In Bruges.
Yes.
And, mm-hmm. you know, there's a beautiful, I mean, I think it's beautiful, where Ralph Fiennes says, you know, if I killed a kid, I'd blow my brains out. No filmmaker in the history of film would have actually done that until, was it Martin McDonagh, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where he thinks he's killed a kid and he immediately kills himself. Those are consequences. And that's something that you don't see in a lot of films. Now, in a film like this, there are consequences to, you know, a lot of filmmakers could have had Baby and Deborah just drive off into the sunset, right? Baby goes to prison. The other gangsters die in a way that was like a shortened version of Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a real problem here, I think, and I don't know if it's white privilege or what. I think it might be white privilege light. But I can't imagine any other film or any other narrative like this in which, let's say, Baby is an African-American. That dude's not getting a suspended sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody is talking about kind of the casual white privilege of this. Like, I personally agree that when somebody's on the stand, we should come to their defense and say, oh, but extenuating circumstances and all this. But I don't think we asked we wouldn't give the opportunity for an African-American character.
Yeah,
I just don't see it.
Well, I mean, we would have
that's
maybe
part of the world.
Yeah, if we would have
part of the world we live in.
There's an expectation. I like to think if we wrote the movie that we would have given them that benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I can't think of as our current industry stands. I think maybe if like a Ryan Coogler or somebody did,
mm-hmm.
you know, Ava DuVernay, obviously, or if it was just an African American writer or director. But I can't think of a white. White straight dude, so to speak, up until now doing that.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. asking us to think about that. And in this case, it happened to be with the white lead character, but I'm not saying Edgar Wright is this, like, I'm not trying to paint him as as anything, right? But
Yeah.
it is, you know, when you start talking about all the people who go, all the notes that go into creating a film, the studio implications, the producers, the director, the writer, you know, it's a complex mix, but it's, he is allowing us space to think about guilt and innocence in a way that few other filmmakers have in a genre like this. But I don't think we can separate that from the fact that it's also a young, straight, white.
Mm-hmm. No.
Violent.
So, so this is one of those things. This is why I was trying to preface this. Like, I agree. I don't think Edgar Wright is trying to, you know, obviously he's trying to make a statement, positive or negative, on anything like
this
that.
This isn't Fruitvale Station.
Yeah, this isn't Fruitvale Station. But, you know, regardless, you know, I'm not sitting there trying to look for, like, specific, like, white privilege or racial inequalities when I'm watching the movie, but having little idea what the movie was about and having no idea where it was going to eventually end up, because I was expecting Edgar Wright to kind of swerve me or do something that I haven't seen, I was having flashbacks a little bit when, and probably because it's culturally relevant right now, when they start to go across, spoilers, I guess. if you've ever listened to the show, we spoil everything. So to talk about theme, you spoil everything. So, stop listening. 3, 2, 1. But, right towards the end of the movie, they're driving that. It certainly looks like some kind of Bronco-esque vehicle, across the bridge, and are confronted with the FBI. Tons of them pointing guns. All these police officers having probably more than a reasonable idea that he is a dangerous person.
He's a murderer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I said, depending on how much of that has been communicated through the public safety channels, like, he should at least be suspected of being armed, if not having actually specifically murdered people. And he does so much in that small amount of time that I feel otherwise, especially if he was black, would have been cause for, like, it would have ended in a different way. And I'm, like, yeah. I said,
I would have been shot.
Yeah. Like, before he even got out, like, as soon as he reached over, I assume that people would have shot at him. When he gets out of the vehicle, I was basically having Get Out flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
Of the specific different feelings that I had, or assumptions that I was personally bringing to the narrative, like, because I think that's one of the, I mean, we talked about it on the Get Out episode. If you haven't listened to it, a lot of you have. I appreciate it. Like, that's what most people sit there and talked about. It was the biggest reaction we got in Get Out, with the crowd that I was watching it with. When the police car pulled up and you knew exactly what the assumption would be, yet in this one, we see Baby root around in the car for all they know, get out, and then, like, of his own volition, and then, like, raise his hands and just kind of stand there. And then, on top of that, what I really thought might happen, because it would make sense with narratives that I'm seeing in the news, is... Deborah, she gets out quickly and recklessly and is, like, reaching for things. And I'm like, I don't know how she didn't get shot, except for the fact that she's white. So I expected it not to happen.
Yeah, there's no weight to that final scene in Baby Driver. Like, not like Get Out.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah,
absolutely.
There's no way to it whatsoever. And so, like, I had no doubt that he was going to survive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the tone of the film. And so, I was sitting there, and that scene did not even register. Like, that was kind of just the... At that point, like, I knew where the film was going, and I did not feel like it was going to go against my expectations at any point. And so...
Well, it did lower the stakes, right? Like, effectively lower the stakes because he was white.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of it. But I also, that's just the way I mean, there's a good portion of heist films where the ending is quote unquote happy. Like everything works out for the main character or characters. And so it would not be like for him to go against the expectation would actually be genre like it would actually go against a genre mentality. And so at that point I was like, oh yeah, no, he's fine. Like he's gonna get out, he's gonna get arrested, he'll probably go to jail and that's it. And
And
I'm
get
like,
out.
that's fine. But there's no weight to it. Like I did not feel anything in that moment. I was just like, yeah, this is the end of the story. Whereas with Get Out, like my heart stopped
Yeah, I
when that
mean,
happened. Because I was like, I don't know what's gonna happen now. I assume what's gonna happen, but I have no idea.
yeah, I mean, like I had apprehension at the at during that scene in Baby Driver, but all that apprehension was thinking about how I felt like watching like Get Out or watching this narrative unfold, having seen so many news stories recently and so much public outcry or apathy, because it seems like it's just a pendulum swinging to two extremes, that like there's just a different expectation. And like I said, I don't think Edgar Wright is, like I said, was making some kind of statement, obviously. I don't think he was being like oblivious or callous to the idea that this is happening because he doesn't address it, or he allows his character to be unscathed by this. I think, again, to try not to co-opt the movie, but I think it's telling of society that, or our culture, that there's an expectation that he's going to be perfectly fine because he gives himself up. Like, and it's not just it's not a traffic stop. Like he's murdered people, you know? And they're just like, he's good. Just
Yeah,
get on your knees, you
and
know?
that's
He
where I'd almost
apologized. He apologized for taking my car.
Yeah, exactly.
My
Yeah,
B.
I think that's where I'd push back against people who are saying it's genre bending, because I really don't feel like it is at all. I really feel like he pretty much follows the trajectory of a good portion of heist films or action films. Like even if there is a consequence and he goes to jail, like he's gonna be fine. Like he'll get out early or he'll escape or whatever it may be. He's gonna come out of this okay.
He's gonna
And
go to
so,
prison and serve some food, mop some floors, and not have any issues at all. It's just like an easy 5 years, and gets out and has the girl of his dreams.
yep, that's
Like
right.
I feel like, gosh, I really don't want to harp on this because I know Gene's gonna love it, but you know, that is just a mindset where we. Let me just speak for me personally then. Personally, I accept that narrative. Like, I accept that as like, yep, that could happen. Whereas if, I mean, even this is something that I did have written down that was kind of baffling to me. Like this idea of blurring the lines between good person doing bad things, you know, and a bad person doing good things. Like, like lots of movies often try to tackle this, but like our hero Baby was like, he was a thief. Like he was a thief before we met him. He was a thief when we met him. You know, like he was doing bad things. Like he
I'm
may have.
surprised.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think you're asking some really good questions, because I'm surprised that more mainstream critics have not brought this up. And like, could you imagine if the identities of the characters were switched between Jamie Foxx and Baby?
Yeah.
Like, Jamie Foxx isn't getting that treatment on the witness stand.
Yeah, there aren't character witness coming back being like, oh, well, I know that he murdered a dude and was robbing a bank, but he kind of told me not to go in there, so he can't be all bad. Like, well, where is that line? Where is this morally relative line that it's okay? Or oh man, see, this is hypothetical, and this is why we're watching a movie, but if the character if that's Michael B. Jordan instead of Ansel Elgort, you know, and he's not played like Jamie Foxx's like over the top loud kind of abrasive character, he's just played like Ansel, he's just Michael B. Jordan instead, He listens to music. His mom died in a tragic way. We're sympathetic towards him. He just wants to, you know, be with his girl and drive. Like, would that white woman come in and be like, he's probably a good guy because he killed some people and told me not to go in the back door? Like,
yeah,
does
yeah.
that happen? Like,
no. No, so here's another thought. And
we're so cynical again, about our society right now. It's just,
yeah,
like, that's not what I wanted this podcast to be, but like, I think it's there. So,
well, yeah, for sure. And so here's the thing is, if it had been Michael B. Jordan in Baby's place,
it'd have been incredibly well acted.
It would have been, yes, it would have been. Yeah, I for sure. Because Michael B. Jordan is amazing. But I would say that having that final showdown with the police with Michael B. Jordan would have added a heft to a film that before that had no heft, like no weight, like no moral weight, like outside of just consequences, like which is showcases, like, that's a heist film. Like, heist films usually have consequences. It's the way they were. It's kind of part of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But there would have been two distinctly different parts of this movie. Like, if you had the first part, where it was pretty much the same thing, and then that ending, there would have been a shift in tone,
yep,
a shift in weight, and it would have probably not been a very good movie, because there was nothing that led up to that decision at the very end. Like, there's no heft leading up to this moment. And so why Get Out works is because there's a heft running throughout the whole film.
Yeah.
That leads to that point, and then it's heart-stopping. Whereas with Baby Driver, it's light. It's playful. It's joyful.
I mean, its ending, ending is befitting its beginning and middle.
Yeah,
exactly. And so while yes, I think it's pretty telling of our society and our time right now that is the way we expect it to happen with a white straight male, is it's something like, it's not what Edgar Wright was trying to go for, because he was just trying to do this kind of fun, poppy little movie. But because of our situation culturally, we can look on that and say it's another example of Hollywood basically doing or taking a white narrative approach to this and not.
Yeah, but so,
like, basically ignoring, like, that aspect, not necessarily intentionally.
Yeah, just by writing the movie.
Just because that's the way. Yeah, exactly.
He just he pointed something out that was there with no intention, just because of. Just by going about his daily business, wanting to tell a story.
Yeah, exactly.
From
because he's also white.
Yeah.
So that's the systemic part of privilege, is that even those that are the best intentioned will fall into the trap of making those same decisions, and so.
No, I mean, I'm. It all makes sense, or at least hopefully. I feel like there is a section of the population, and I think, sadly, a large section of that population would describe themselves as Christian, or at least faith-centered, some, you know, kind of reason like that, who think that white privilege is not a thing, who think that everyone is totally equal in everyone's eyes and everyone has the same chance at things. And while I can easily get behind like arguments that look to find pieces of privilege, whether it's male privilege or white privilege or whatever, in places that it might not be, or intentional actions based out of that privilege where it might be unintentional, or kind of like we're talking about Edgar Wright, like a byproduct of just wanting to tell a story. It's not intentionally harmful. I think the denial that it exists is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are probably people listening to this episode right now who have already kind of, like, their eyes maybe have already glazed over because we've already talked about this way longer than they want to. And I just want to encourage you that I find it hard to reconcile my faith with the world without acknowledging the fact that things aren't fair. Like,
yeah.
Like, there are things that I assume that people of different either races or even, I mean, faith backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, different countries, like, they would never assume the same way as me. And I think when we can start to admit that, we don't see it as an accusation of our badness or our wrongness, but we can see it as a road that we can use to
reconcile. I don't understand how if I start meddling here, you can edit it out or tell me to shut up.
Oh yeah, I'll totally edit because I have lots of free time. So
there's a few more things I'd like to turn the knife on too, real fast.
Yeah, I don't understand how in a world like in an evangelical Christian mindset, because most of your white privilege deniers fall under under a more conservative theology, not all, but most. And for a central tenet of their theology to be the brokenness of the world that we live in, I don't understand how it's such a huge leap to say, yes, that is just one characteristic of the broken world that we live in. Even if you wanted to go just on a very conservative sin-based worldview or whatever, I'll never understand that ability to make the jump. But this film is an example of just how, and I think part, Mikey, of your ability to like talk about this, and then like our inability to get our heads around it 100%, is that it is the taken for grantedness of that systemic reality.
Yeah.
That it just is so baked into the culture that I don't imagine Edgar Wright like could have thought to tell it another way.
Yeah.
Now that's a problem, right? But I think Edgar Wright is Michael B. Jordan or Ryan Coogler or somebody else whose experience that has been, then that's where that narrative comes from.
Yeah. It's white people telling white narratives.
Yeah. Well, and so I want to be careful because, like I said, one of the things that I really enjoy about doing real world theology is the fact that it hopefully is starting considerate and thoughtful conversations among like all like diversions of Christian faith. And we all come from different backgrounds and sometimes we're exposed to ideas that are new. And I think it is true and a right thing to tell people who come from a more evangelical kind of conservative mindset that want to either deny the systemic privileges of different cultural things. I think it's good to call that out. I just want to make sure we're not doing it to the detriment that like, just because someone else is more progressive, that they don't necessarily have all the right answers either. The only answer in all of this is the gospel. It's Christ. Like us being better people, sure, it can help society. Us recognizing and admitting that there's white privilege, that will help, you know, that will help, because to kind of address a problem, you have to admit that there's a problem. But moving away from just having people admit that they're doing something or being a part of a problem isn't in and of itself the solution, which is, like I said, would be my counter criticism of, like I said, the pendulum swinging the other way. So I want to make sure that everyone who's a Christian in this conversation or listening to this feels bad equally. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like
it's all of our faults.
Yeah, I'm gonna say
we're all to blame in this.
Yeah, so. And it's not even just my privilege. It's my sinful nature. It's the fact that I think that if I'm just nicer to people, the world's gonna get better, because I think that I have the power in and of myself to fix this. And while I do need to act, and my words and my thoughts and my faith needs to lead to action, I am not the changer of hearts. I'm not the fixer of the world. I'm not the healer. I'm not the resurrection. I'm a channel for that, but I am not, and I can't fix it. And I want to make sure that we're not bagging on one particular subset of Christianity. Yeah. So, but I do think that truth needs to be called, or, you know, spade needs to be called a spade. And it's true that privilege exists in a broken and fallen world, like Ryan, you're saying. With that, I think that Blake has some knives that he wants to turn.
Well, it's one in general, because I think to make a point of to go a little bit further in and show maybe how this privilege does play itself out in the film is that if you look at the soundtrack, with the exception of maybe three or four artists or bands, is largely soul oriented or largely hip hop oriented or funk oriented. And that is all black music.
Mm-hmm.
And Edgar Wright is appropriating that music to tell his tale, which is part of the casual privilege of the film, is that he is using he's taking music that has a specific context and a specific culture that created it, and he's taking it out of that context and using it for his own white narrative. And so even on the musical side of it, there's an issue, or at least there's a potential issue going on there that could lead into the similar problem of the ending and just the nature of, you know, how Hollywood makes films with largely white male audiences in mind. And so, I think just to turn it a little bit more, you could even see it in the music and the very soundtrack. Mm-hmm.
And it's far from like, it's not like this is the only example. It's not like this is the only movie that's ever done
not
this.
At all.
Yeah. So like I said, it's, again, where we are not trying to appropriate Edgar Wright's film, but like many films we see, it actually tells us more about ourselves. This is kind of like a conversation that I had recently with a friend who was ragging on Michael Bay because he makes the Transformers movies. And to a certain degree, I think Michael Bay should be ragged on for making the Transformers movies. But there is popular theory that, like, who's really to blame? If Michael Bay makes a terrible Transformer movie that is often, like, misogynistic and racist and just, you know, terrible storytelling, but he makes like $1 billion making it, like, whose fault is that? Like, who does that really, put up a mirror to Michael Bay, or does it put up a mirror to the people who were paying to see the film, if this is what they're entertained by?
Yeah, I mean, you're asking to bring up all this is not to, you know, we're making these like addressing legitimate concerns about like making sure that everyone is sharing in this kind of, or acknowledging complicity in this kind of broken system, you know, but to acknowledge it is not to say that other truths or experiences or perspectives don't exist, you know?
Yeah.
But you're asking larger systemic questions about entertainment in general, because Michael Bay's movies are not made for American audiences anymore.
Yeah. That's...
I mean,
to a large degree.
There is a certain American that will go see that film and love it, or a certain moviegoer. I mean, I've seen all the Transformers movies in the theater. But
you're the problem. Oh, my God.
China. And me, so is China. You know?
Well, to be fair, you, me, and China.
Yeah. So, you know, but again, I think the fact that you ask this question and the fact that it's coming from a person of faith is very important, because these are the types of questions that historically faith-based culture critics have not asked, right? It's all been about the content, boobs and cuss words and violence, although violence takes a back seat. You're asking industrial business questions, right? Is it what the world wants, or is it what the studios are giving the world? And I think it is both and.
Yeah.
And both deserve criticism.
I'm totally on board. It's like when something bad happens in society. You know, there is a shooting, and everyone's like, "I've got the thing to blame." And like, is it the weapon? Is it the person? Is it the system that raised it up? Is it the news organizations that they watched or didn't watch? Like, yes. And more, you know, is it the fact that we live in a broken world? I always love seeing that. Well, we can't do anything about, you know, bad things happening because it's, you know, sin is human nature and people do bad things. I guess we shouldn't do anything. Well, that just seems like a terrible answer. Acknowledging a reality. Yeah, acknowledging a reality does not. Anyway, like I said, that's a whole other tangent. But point being. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you're just asking questions about the nature of the industry, you know, and how it's the drug. It's the drug dealer. Like, do you blame the addict? Do you blame the drug dealer? It's both.
Well, I was going to say that's what they're asking. What in the Philippines right now, right?
And also blame Reagan, but that's a whole other issue.
Hashtag blame Reagan. I'm sure that's going to go far. You'll get lots of Twitter followers. Well, so at one point we were talking about Baby Driver many minutes ago. In a way, we've never stopped talking about it, which is the kind of cool thing about this entire conversation. But to talk more specifically about the movie, to kind of get us in the general wrap-up mode, because we're recording at a very odd time. It's the 4th today. I don't know. I can't remember when this is going to go up, probably the 10th. So we've all got things we'd like to go do. So to get us in the wrap-up mode, specifically about the film, we usually do our come-on moments, our moments that say, that didn't feel right, that didn't work for me, made me scratch my head, or flat out, you were in the theater and you just said, come on. Now, to a certain degree, it's hard to imagine there being tons of those moments that are negative. I can imagine lots of, come on! That's crazy moments with Edgar Wright, but it seems like there wouldn't be quite as many negative. But I have a couple myself, and I'm curious where you guys landed. So, Ryan, what was it when you were watching this movie, if there was anything, I guess, that just kind of you thought could be done better or made you say, come on?
Yeah, I think the come on moment for me was just the end. We've talked a lot about it, so I won't beat a dead horse, but I think it was just the ending and kind of the break that mm-hmm. he got.
Yeah.
And again, it was a knowing come on. Like, it was, yeah, I see, you know, but it didn't ruin the film for me at mm-hmm. all. I mean, there were a lot of more excited, oh my gosh, that, can you believe that? Like, cool moments.
Yeah.
But that was just it for me. That was the one, really my only beef with the film. And mm-hmm. we've put that in context. So
yeah. Blake.
Yeah. I'll have to second that completely. I not only did it feel rushed, but it also, like we've talked about already, it felt, knowingly, it felt problematic, just in the nature of the society we live in. But it was a knowing, like, we knew this was going to be the way this film would end, because nothing up to that point had made us think that it was going to have a heavier ending. And so, yeah, I would have to piggyback on to Ryan's.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to kind of diverge outside of the obvious thing that we've been talking about for a while. I'm going to lay all my cards on the table. I do love Edgar Wright. I think I watched one preview for this movie because it was in front of another movie that I went to see. Like, I would have not watched any previews for this movie because Edgar Wright wrote and directed it. That's all I needed. As it stands right now, this is probably my least favorite Edgar Wright movie.
Interesting.
Easily my least favorite Edgar Wright movie.
Wow.
Which bums me out, because, like I said, I was obviously expecting, you know, whatever. But I really had no idea what a lot of it was about. And I think it's for a couple reasons. He's doing, I think, something here that he has not done in previous films. So what I'm expecting from the other films, I'm not getting in this one. I'm not getting a movie that's like funny just on all kinds of levels. That is really using humor to break down other genres. I feel that one of the things that I could point to before this movie was something that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, that Edgar Wright, like I said, does not waste anything. And not only does he not waste anything, but he's busy not wasting things to tell you about a character and a character's backstory, or everything you need to know about a character. And in this one, I felt like there were so many times where people were just sitting around. Even though it was kind of like in a cool setting, people were just explaining who other people were. Or we were getting very kind of shocking flashbacks that didn't really seem to flow for me as well. I was sitting there like kind of mouth agape, just saying like, why is Kevin Spacey giving me like a narration about who this kid is? Like, this is not something I would expect to get in an Edgar Wright film. I would expect to get like four quick, like 1 second, like cuts that would tell me everything I need to know about this kid. Without having anyone say a word.
I'll tell you why. It's because he needed to give Kevin Spacey something to talk about.
Yeah.
Well, but that's the thing. So we've talked about it probably every time we've talked about a Pixar movie, but we talked about it specifically last episode on the Cars 3 episode, and you know, Pixar is its own worst enemy. In this case, I feel like Edgar Wright is his own worst enemy. I love his films so much that I've come to expect a level of storytelling and a type of storytelling and a skill at not just storytelling, but like editing, and writing that I didn't feel like I got in this film. And so when I talk about come on moments, like I said, I really did. There were one or two times when people were explaining characters to other people and I said, come on, like what's happening? Is this just like a trope that I'm missing in the heist kind of thing that I felt like you could have got time, around?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times you. Yeah, there's ways he could have gotten around it, but yeah, it's a trope of heist films.
So I think I could have forgiven it if, honestly, probably my biggest gripe about the film was its casting. I just don't really like Ansel Elgort that much.
Really.
He just doesn't. He was in like The Fault in Our Stars, right? He was in.
Oh, I have no idea.
Something. He was in like
bad teen movies.
He was in like all the teen. Like, wasn't he in Divergence too? And he like the brother or something.
I have no idea. I haven't seen any of those movies.
I just don't really like him that much. I was kind of assuming he'd be like a Miles Teller, where I don't like him that much at first, but he kind of grows on me. But he's not grown on me yet. I have historically really liked Lily James, but I just didn't care about her character at all.
I didn't care for her character either. You and I will have a fist fight about Ansel Elgort though.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, and I'm not a John Hamm fan either.
Yeah, I'm not either. Like, I like the fact that John Hamm realized, like, I don't know, 5 or 7 years ago that it's incredibly hilarious if he does kind of funny things.
Mm-hmm.
And can kind of make fun of like the persona that he basically comes off as like a tall, good looking white guy, and can mm-hmm. kind of put himself in these other roles and how that's comedic. And I've enjoyed that. Like with him.
I like how, when it's all said and done and we look back, I think the career that, we can thank Mad Men for is Elizabeth Moss in the midst of all this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you would watch all the way through, right? Like, you watch Mad Men, you're like, oh, John Hamm, he's going to be a real star. The real talent all along was Peggy.
Gosh, that's another conversation, because I wish I could have finished Mad Men, based on what people said. I just couldn't. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I couldn't either.
But yeah, dude, especially working through The Handmaid's Tale now, I mean, like, yeah, she's what's up. But I like John Hamm and like, funny things. I think he's great in Kimmy Schmidt. I think he was great in 30 Rock. But anyway, all that to say, like, for some reason, he just didn't feel right in this movie. Even, like, Jamie Foxx I feel like he's in a more serious film than this one.
Yeah, they're in different movies.
Like I said, again, it's, like, on paper, it seemed like all these casting choices are great, but when they came together, something about it just didn't work for me, and I think because of that, I just didn't care about the characters, and every time they wanted me to care about something, this quote unquote millennial love story, I just was like, okay, whatever. Come on, like, I care about every single character, like, in all of Edgar Wright's other movies, like all the exes from Scott Pilgrim. I think I'm like these are all awesome. Like, I'm invested in all these characters and why they're there and what they're doing. Same thing with like the Cornetto trilogy. All those relationships all have weight to me. And it just didn't, I just didn't work. And I feel bad because I want to like this movie more than I did.
And looking back on it, like I almost have to agree with you on the sense that the only character I actually did care about throughout the film was Baby. Like, that was the only character that really kind of captured my attention. And I thought Ansel Elgort was marvelous. I thought he was a standout of the whole movie. I thought the way he was able to communicate a lot of things through nonverbal means was pretty stellar. But like you said, like, none of the other characters really captured me in any kind of way. And really, it was just me wanting to see Baby's story come to completion.
Yeah, it's tough, too, because so. I can't necessarily fault any kind of acting specific choice that Ansel did. Like, I don't want to say like, oh, he's a bad actor and I just hate him. It's just, for some reason, he doesn't draw me in. There's not like a charisma that connects with me personally. Now maybe if they put The Rock in his thing, you know, I'm like, that would have instantly improved this film. Or again, Idris Elba. Idris Elba,
yeah, there you go.
As
yeah,
Baby,
no doubt.
I would have loved it. He would have got Idris Elba would have gotten out of the car at the end and murdered all of the FBI because he could have without a gun. Like, it would just, like, he would have, I don't know, been cross with them or something.
With that beautiful stare of his.
That's right. He's like, what are you doing? And then they all just like fall off the bridge because they can't take it. So I didn't necessarily mean for my come on moment to be basically like my gripe session about the film. But yeah. Like I said, it's the space for it that come on moments kind of takes.
It's good to have measured criticism.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that because there wasn't one moment. There wasn't like one moment that I said this is dumb, because there wasn't anything that I thought was really dumb in the film. It was just when I was sitting there, I was like, this doesn't feel right, and that's the closest thing. So, but as I say, we end positively, because this is still this is a very fine film, and well worth your time, especially when you take a step back and look at the grand scheme of movies that are coming out. Like, you could do far worse, so far worse with your dollar than not giving it to Edgar Wright to making sure that he can make more films. I want to know, Ryan, what was your favorite thing in this movie?
Favorite thing in the movie? Mm-hmm. Oh. That's a big, let's see.
No pressure. Or your favorite couple things. Just like something, like things that you think fondly of. You're excited to see again when you watch it a second time.
Yeah, okay. I think for me, it was just the editing. And it delivered on what I expected. I wasn't disappointed, because I can't tell you how many times I've watched Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And probably in that order. And then Scott Pilgrim, but it delivered on what I wanted from the film when I went, which was this kind of smart editing choices, the way the sound design worked with the editing and the cutaways and transitions and things like that. So that was probably my favorite part, and that's why I will watch it again.
Cool. Blake?
So there's a specific scene that I keep going back to and chuckling about, and that's the them getting into the car and they have the Mike Myers mask.
Mm-hmm.
Myers mask. And that whole scene. So from that moment where they try to get the guy to understand that he got the wrong mask, but also that part where Baby's playing, like, the music is playing over that scene and they're about to get out of the car and Baby's like, hold on. And he has to like run the track back to the beginning. And then he starts it again. That's when they get out of the car. Like, yeah. I chuckle every time I think about that, because that was, not only is that really meta about how he's kind of working the music into the plot, but it's just really well done. Like, mm-hmm. it was a moment where it did not take you out of the film, but you consciously know what he's doing in that moment. And it's kind of beautiful. It's really my favorite scene in the whole film.
Let's see. So probably my favorite thing was the opening car chase when he was in the Subaru.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably set the tone for why it didn't maybe fully live up to my expectations, because I said, if this is the one they're opening the film with, I can't wait to see like the other two or three they're going to do.
That's a good point.
And yeah. I think it was so far above, especially any other car chasing in the movie,
mm-hmm.
that it kind of was downhill from there. Because it was so good. It's one of the most entertaining, kind of fun car chase scenes I've seen in a long time. I want to say ever, but I'm trying to steer away from absolutes. But the only thing else, other thing in the film that I thought was close was actually the foot chase scene, which I thought was good, because I thought unless I was missing something or putting something that wasn't there, it looked like it paralleled the opening car chase scene in a lot of ways, a lot of very mm-hmm. specific ways. It was basically a car chase on foot, and I thought that was incredibly creative. And another yeah. thing that was, to in and of itself, kind of meta, you know, basically like, hey, if he can do this in a car, like he would have these same instincts on foot. And so those are probably my two favorite things, or my favorite things in the movie, that foot chase scene and the car chase scene. And I think both of those made me want more of that because it was so good. Something that wasn't my favorite, but no one's mentioned it, and I just want to mention it because I love these ideas in Edgar Wright films, where it's like you can tell like he had a great idea and he put it in there, and people might not notice it like totally the first time, and it rewards itself repeat viewings. And that was when he went to get coffee the first time, and like all the song lyrics, were like on the flyers and like spray painted on the walls, like just as he was walking by, going back to like what Blake was talking about really early in the show about how there's like a specific choreography to everything. And so we have Baby walking by like a wall just at the part where it's like, yeah, yeah. And it's like, yeah, yeah, is written on the wall. and I was like, that just, it's kind of cool that it's there. It reminded me of, like I said, what I really love about Edgar Wright, and that's his attention to detail. The kind of detail.
Well, he's really joyful in the way yeah. he makes films.
So it looked like he was having
yeah.
fun.
Yeah.
All right. So with that said, we will wrap up, because I want to ask you guys one more question, and we'll just kind of put this in lieu of like our final thoughts, even though, you know, as usual, you're welcome to talk about whatever you'd like. But kind of like for our final thought, along with like, any last kind of sentence you want to say about the film, anything we might have missed. I want to know if you guys have like a song, like your driving song, like your, the one song that you can just kind of get you revved up or pumped, so that we can all equally judge each other for our taste in music, or expose someone to a song they've never heard before. What are we doing? It's Ryan. What is your, any final thoughts on the film, along with what's your driving song?
Oh, driving song. That's a great question. I remember, you guys all probably remember making like mixed CDs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Like road trip CDs. You don't really do that anymore. I don't know. I think it really depends on the mood. Am I going to a meeting? Am I leaving a meeting? Where am I going? I think that's a huge, component to it. I think for like long trips, I go lean towards like Ryan Adams, like kind of more alt country. And then like if I need to get like picked up, I think it's probably like rap or like hip hop or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe I'm going to go genre and moment. I think one of my favorite songs is Bittersweet Symphony.
Oh, nice.
I go to like, but I don't know if that's, is that the name of the song?
Yeah. That's the Verve.
Yeah. 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 I tell my wife, that's what I want at my funeral.
You're going to have a 90s funeral. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And, that. And I had a friend who said, their funeral, the only song they wanted was another one, Bites the Dust by Queen.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's my driving music.
Cool.
Or sports talk radio. I listen to a lot of radio sports talk.
It's hard to listen to sports talk radio right now because there's nothing happening.
That's yeah. true. That's very true.
Well, in the grand scheme of things, there's nothing happening. I did the same thing. I listen to NPR now. Gosh.
Oh, God. What a liberal.
What a liberal, right? Such a progressive. just because I want to know what's going on in the country.
Just even-handed news.
Yeah. Just, hey, these are the things that happened. Okay, thanks. That's what I needed to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Blake, you know, what? Any last things about Baby Driver? What's your driving song?
So really the only thought I can think of to end on Baby Driver is go see it, enjoy it. Like it's a movie that you can just go to and enjoy for what it is. Yes, take into account some of the things that we brought up in this episode, but that doesn't mean that you can't come out of it really having enjoyed it as well. And so, yeah, there's that. Driving music changes so much for me. I've had driving songs almost, you know, monthly. And so it shifts a lot. Lately though, it's probably been, Yeah Right off of Vince Staples' new album, and Chase Me, which is the, Run the Jewels Big Boy track on the Baby Driver soundtrack. Both of those have been, pretty heavily rotated on my stereo as I was driving. But like Ryan and, it depends on what I'm doing. So like long road trips, I end up probably listening to Jason Isbell a lot and crying.
I've been playing the heck out of that. I've been playing the heck out of that new Vince Staples album.
Oh man, it's amazing. I love
it. So good. Yeah.
Hold on. I gotta make some notes real quick. Doesn't have time to look up new music anymore.
I made a whole playlist for you.
I know. I'm working through it. One of the things, like a life goal, such a lame life goal, is to eventually be in a job where I can listen to music while I do my job.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm currently, my day job is not something where I can really listen to music. Like I can have music on in the background, but I want to listen to music. I want to be able to sing along to the music. And currently in my job, it is very difficult for me to listen to something and also do my job. So I'm hoping that one day I can have an office and play my music and be like, look at all the things that Blake has made for me to listen to. And it'll be grand and glorious. So now it gets through very slowly. I think I've only made it through like two albums so far.
Yeah.
It's depressing. Well, not the music.
There's a lot.
Also, yes, that was like the longest playlist ever. I was kind of asking you to make me a playlist because I thought you would make me like, oh, here's like 50 songs that I think are really great. And you're like, here's like the last 100 albums that I've listened to. I'm like, okay, well.
Well, no, it was my favorite albums of each year of the last 5 years.
So it's given. I got more than I asked for, so I consider it a bargain. So
there you go.
So like for me, for Baby Driver, I liked it less than I liked any other Edgar Wright film, but that bar is so incredibly high. For me, like they're my favorite directors are, you know, Edgar Wright is easily in my top five. Like I'll go see anything that Ryan Coogler makes, anything that Damien Chazelle makes, anything that Edgar Wright makes. So great. Go see it. It's still, you know, even if you have some issues with it, even we raised some things that it kind of holds that mirror up to us. Which is, you know, just things that movies do. It's the stories we tell. My driving song, I don't necessarily think I seek these songs out, but I notice that anytime I am driving, because I like you guys, depending on where I'm going, what I'm doing, I tend to have different interests. Actually, like when I was driving cross country in my younger years, I used to listen to comedians. Like I would just listen to stand up on long road trips because it always actively engaged my brain. So like on a 15-hour mm-hmm. drive, like I never kind of started zoning out like towards the end of an album. I was always, which I guess kind of what sports talk does now, except during this time of year. But songs again, I'm super lame. Sorry. But, Needle in a Haystack Life by Switchfoot.
Yep.
Actively makes me drive faster. Like, you know, like when you like look down, you're like, oh crap. I'm like going like 15, 20 over. Like, I actively drive faster when that song comes on. And probably one of my favorite songs of all time is also one of those songs where I start driving faster. And that's Sweetness by Jimmy Eat World.
Nice.
So, like I said, I look nice. Down and I'm going, I am now speeding an uncomfortable level of speedingness. People mistake me for baby because I'm driving so fast and so furious.
And backwards.
With that, I've really enjoyed this, and I think this will end up being a slightly shorter episode. Again, you know, that's what happens when you try to fit things in around a holiday, but that's fine. This movie actually lent itself to, I think, to a shorter conversation, so we didn't hopefully bore everyone out there. I think we got, obviously, like Ryan pointed out, I'm kind of surprised that some of the things we ended up talking about, maybe it's just because we're so smart, we hit on
that's
some
totally
things.
It.
That's probably it. That we hit on some things that I have actually not read in any review yet. And so I'm waiting for one of us to write that article with a very clickbaity headline and get lots of traffic and, you know, shared through Twitter and all that stuff. So look for that, that viral, campaign.
It's going to put us on the map.
It is. This is going to be the thing that it's going to be like when we, like I said, when we wrote about how it's okay for Christians to watch Deadpool and like we had so many people going to our site that it, you know, just a whole bunch of, you know, Christians who wanted to see it anyway, who were just looking for justification to tell their friends. They're like, well, this site said it was okay. And they seem to kind of be Christian sometimes. Anyway, I think great conversations happen because we have great guests on. And so I really appreciate Ryan and Blake taking the time to join me. I feel like I'm having a lot of Ryans on lately. But Ryan Parker, it was your first time on the show.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. Yeah,
I appreciate it. And I want to make sure that people can follow the stuff that you guys are doing. So Ryan, how can people follow whatever it is that you do?
We'll do two things. We're at Pop Theology, which is poptheology.com, and on Twitter at Pop Theology.
Mm-hmm.
There's articles there. We do a podcast called Killer Serials where we talk about TV one episode at a time. And then if you're a movie lover out there, if you're a faith leader or blogger or whatever, you can reach me at ryan@witpr.com if you want to learn more about early access to films and all that good stuff.
He's the man. He's the gatekeeper.
Ha.
I'm not sure who the keymaster is because that makes it kind of weird. Blake, are you the keymaster? Because that's kind of weird.
No.
I'm uncomfortable answering this question. Well, Blake, how can people find you on the web and find the work that you do?
There's this really good site called Real World Theology.
It's the best.
That I don't know if y'all know anything
about.
You've
heard of it.
So, I write about horror films mainly, but I also write reviews about films like Baby Driver and Hacksaw Ridge. Occasionally I'll do something outside the horror realm, and it's shocking to everybody when it happens.
Well, I don't know how you have really.
Yeah, it's going to get interesting here in the next few months for various reasons. But I write a bi-monthly column there, and then you can find me on Twitter at Blake I. Collier, and you can find me at my website. You read anything I've written pretty much in the last 5-6 years of my life at LakeEyeCollier.com.
So. Did you kind of pimp your podcast? Did you do that?
Which one?
I don't care. All of them.
Yeah, no. So
no one has more podcasts than JR, so it doesn't matter.
That's true. That is true. Yes, along with the Real World Theology column, one of the podcasts that I host and produce is The Body of the Blood, which is about horror. Surprise, surprise. And I have my good friends Andy Whitfield and Ian Olson to tear apart films and tie them to older films and kind of bring them into conversation with each other. It's a fun time. We're generally comedic because Andy is kind of our common man and he likes to go against anything that Ian and I talk about because we're kind of self-serious sometimes. So that's kind of the rhythm of the podcast, but it's fun. Check us out at The Body of the Blood and at The Body of the Blood on Twitter.
Awesome. And as for me, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by going to realworldtheology.com/support and see how you can do that. There's various ways. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. On iTunes is probably the easiest, but Stitcher, any other, whatever app, podcast app you use, subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It's incredibly helpful. We try to, like I said, we try to be everywhere. We try to give shout outs to reviews. And we're just, like I said, I can't really express to non-podcasters how helpful reviews are to podcasters. It just helps people find the show. More people are involved in this conversation. We can have better conversations with people who are looking to really dive into the narratives that are shaping our culture. So for now, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you guys that story is powerful, entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
This week on the podcast, Ryan Parker, the guy who sends us emails, and
that's the best definition of what I do. And we're back.
And we're back. Sorry, I just got back from the bathroom, guys. Did I miss anything?
Yeah.